Is it recording? Okay. So this is Regina Kong interviewing for the Hobbit Hole Oral History Project. Today is July 8th, 2019, and I am with Jane Button at her home in Gustavus, Alaska. Could you start just by restating your name for me and telling me a little bit about where you were born?
I'm Jane Button, and I was born in Reno, Nevada in 1957 at St. Mary's Hospital. And I lived in Reno much of my life until I had a freshman year of college away, and I lived in San Francisco for a few years. And then I was back in Reno when I came to visit the Hobbit Hole. And then I fell in love with Greg Howe, and then I moved to the Hobbit Hole the following year after I went and completed my teaching contract.
Tell me more about what it was like growing up in Reno.
Oh.
Like your neighborhood, community, your family.
Reno was a great place. Perfect. I feel it has the perfect climate because it has all four seasons, but none of them is too severe. And the proximity to Lake Tahoe, San Francisco, Pyramid Lake, Northern Nevada's great. And it's become a lot warmer now than it was when I lived there. So that's a downside now, but I don't live there now. I just lived in a neighborhood, and you know, at that time you just went out the door in the morning in the summertime and played all day, and went, maybe came home for lunch and went back out and played all day, and there wasn't so much sort of stranger danger, and there was never such a thing as a play date. My family went to church, my mother and myself and maybe my brother went to church on Sundays, and you would often go home with a friend from church. So that was as much of a play date as existed then. And it just cracks me up now how everybody's so organized, and you know, because you have to keep closer track of your kids. Although I hear in the news a lot more about free range parenting now, so maybe they are giving their kids a little more. But I mean, I was 5 years old. I walked across the university campus to get to my elementary school at five, alone. And nobody thought twice about it. And then back home again in the afternoon. And I wonder how far that was. It was probably a mile or less. But for a five-year-old, it was, you know, big. But no one ever bothered me.
And what did your parents do?
My mother was a nurse, and her specialty was OB. And my dad was a lot of things, but the last two things he did was he was a stockbroker, and then he became the Deputy Secretary of State for the state of Nevada, in specializing in securities, because there's a lot of fraud in the state of Nevada, as you might imagine. People trying to get rich quick. And so anyone who wanted to sell stock in anything had to be cleared by his office. So he investigated people that were selling stock. And that was the last job he had. And then he thought for sure that he would die young, and then he didn't. So he quit working because he didn't want to work till he died. And so then he did a lot of different things, and he was a gypsy at heart. Sometime when I was an adult living in San Francisco, my parents split up, which was good because they should have. But they remained friends, and that was good for us kids. And he was kind of a gypsy. He just, you know, moved from place to place and didn't really have a fixed abode or anything. And
do you think you got any of that from him?
I love to travel, but I feel like I got that from my mother. So I like to have a home, and I really, really like to travel. But I really think one of the main reasons you travel is because it's so, really, you realize how great it is to come home again. And sometimes Greg is a little annoyed at how much I travel, but I just say, I wouldn't have met you if I hadn't been a traveler. So then he usually calms down.
So what does the landscape of Reno look like? If you describe it.
It depends on the season. In winter, it's quite bleak. But in summer, spring and summer, it's just gorgeous because there's a lot of big old trees in the older parts of town, which I prefer. And it's known as the City of Trembling Leaves because there are a lot of aspen trees, which the leaves quake. They call them quaking aspens. And there's a book called The City of Trembling Leaves by Walter Van Tilburg Clark, who wrote about Reno. I don't think I've ever read that book, but so it was beautiful, I think. And the Truckee River runs right through the middle of town. So there's a fresh water smell there. And when I first climbed out of the car, the first time I came here to this little cabin next door, I thought, oh, this feels so good here. You know, I just got the greatest hit of this place is good for me. And I think it's because the river's right there and the fresh water smell, you know, which is really different from the salt water smell. But it was just more a feeling than a, I mean, I don't think I actually smelled it or was not conscious of it. It just was a nice little town. It's much bigger now, but it was, you know, down, and there's the whole casino trip, right, which is downtown, but you don't, it didn't affect me as a, you know, we walked right through it to go to church or home from church if we walked home, and it just was there, you know, it was normal because I'd seen it my whole life. And
did you have siblings?
I have one older brother who, he's like 2.5 years older than me. And then it has turned out within the last, this is 19, I think in 2014, I discovered that I have a sister, that my mom had a baby before she was with my dad. And so I have a sister who sent me those candles that you commented on. So she's a little older, and I mean, she's not that much older. She's, I don't think she's even 5 years older than me, maybe four. So I think she was born in 52 and I was 57. So whatever, December and I'm January, so we have to do math on that. But that's been a real awesome thing to have, because I always wanted a sister, and she's a great one.
Where does she live?
San Jose.
Oh.
Near you.
Oh, yeah. Well, how did you find her?
Well, she found my mom, because she'd been looking for her birth mother, but it was a, you know, secret, private adoption. And my mom, like I said, was a nurse, and I think when she discovered she was pregnant, she left her home, family home in Arizona, because she knew this was never going to fly. And she moved to San Francisco. Actually, I think she was working at Stanford Hospital. And she must have carried really small, and she worked nights. So it was, you know, not a super public thing, and of course filled with shame because it was 1952. And someone on the staff knew that this family was looking to adopt another baby. They already had adopted one. And so they adopted, they, you know, worked it all out. And anyway, so it was all private papers. And then her name's Carol, Sister Carol, we call her. Sister Carol's adoptive dad passed away in 1954. passed away. And her mom, her adoptive mom, died when she was 10 years old. So that was a super big loss and trauma. And then the dad had two adopted daughters, and then they had had a baby the regular way. So he's a widower with three little girls. And so he, of course, remarried right away. And that lady was not as awesome as she might have been, according to Carol. And anyway, when the adoptive dad died, the stepmom gave Carol some papers from the safety deposit box. And that was some key information. And that she had another friend who was really knowledgeable about how to use the internet to do genealogical research. So she found, there's a site called findagrave.com.
Find a grave?
Find a grave. And so she had my grandfather's name from some of the documents of the adoption. And then you look on Find a Grave and you find that. And you can find that they have a picture of the headstone. And then there's another tab where they might have the obit. And you know, in an obituary, they say, they list the children, and usually who, you know, like their spouse would be in parenthesis, and where they live. So that was a key piece of information. And then you can look up old phone books. And so she found my mom's phone number, and she called. And by this time, my mom was in her 90s, and she was kind of with it, not totally out of it, and not totally with it. You know, it kind of changed from day to day. And my sister-in-law was staying there with her because she wasn't really good to be on her own totally anymore. And so my sister-in-law fielded this call, and she said, and then she's like, well, I have no idea what you're talking about. This is totally impossible. She just could not imagine it. And so she hung up with Carol, and she called me, and she said, are you sitting down? And I said, I am now. And she said, somebody just called, and they said that your mom is her mom. That can't possibly be true. And I said, well, of course it can be true. These things have been happening forever, and it would explain a lot of things about my mom. Who she had real bad depression. And, you know, I'd call it manic depression, but her mania was like most people's normal functioning. And anyway, you know, I got right on the phone with her, and she sent me these pictures of herself, and it was just obvious that she was, you know, a relative. She looked so much like some of my cousins. And so anyway, that's my sibling story.
Wow.
Shocking. And awesome. And you know, when you start talking about this story, so many people have it.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, people in my generation, because it was such a shameful thing, you know, that people really did keep it a secret. And my mom, depending on her state, you know, because we are like, oh shoot, how's the best way to handle this? Because I wanted to be sure to give my mom some power in the situation. And so we ended up, she wrote a letter, and mom just kind of like, oh, she did not want a deal. And did you get him? So, anyway, I engineered a meeting between the two of them without telling mom that Carol was her daughter. But I think she knew on some level, because there were several different things that happened that made me think she knows something. Because she really remembered that meeting, and she was very, she was getting to the point where she didn't have much of a short-term memory. So she, you know, wouldn't really be able to tell you what she had for breakfast or dinner or anything. But she I was wearing a scarf one day, and she goes, "Oh, that's a really pretty scarf. Where did you get that?" And I said, "Oh, a friend gave it to me." And she goes, "What friend?" I said, "Well, her name's Carol." And she goes, "Is she the lady who came to see my buttons?" Because my mom was a button collector, which I'll show you. There's some hanging on the wall there. And I said, "Uh-huh." And so then one day, again, sister-in-law calls and goes, "Oh, your mom wants to talk about Carol, and I don't know what to say." And I said, "Put her on. I know what to say." And so we talked, and I said, "I just want to make sure you know about this." And I said, "I know about it, and I'm over the moon, Mom. I'm so happy to have a sister." And so I said, "Do you want to talk to her? Do you want to meet her?" And she goes, "Yes." And so I go, "Well, let's hang up, and I'll call her and have her call you." So they did that, and they had a conversation, which Carol said was a little bit, there was a little confusion, but, and, you know, she said, "Yeah, I'll come up and visit," because it's not that far from San Jose to Reno. And then the next day, that window was totally closed again. Mom was not going down that road. So, you know, I did the best I could. They got to meet, they got to talk, Carol got to be acknowledged, you know, and I don't know what it feels like to be adopted or given up by your, you know, birth mother, but I think that for a lot of adopted kids have issues around that, because it's like the ultimate rejection to start with. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how that maybe is how it is interpreted. So, anyway, we did the best we could. And I think it was as satisfying as it could have been for Carol, and, you know, and our relationship goes on.
Yeah, it's really cool to find that you have a sister.
Right.
You mentioned that you went to San Francisco freshman year of college, is it?
No, I was out of school when I moved to San Francisco. Mm.
Why did you move to San Francisco?
I just had always wanted to live there. Because Mom had lived there.
Mm-hmm.
She was a faculty member at the University of Nevada, Reno School of Nursing, Orvis School of Nursing. And then they wanted all their faculty to at least have a master's. So she went down there when I was 5 years old to get a master's at UCSF. And then, you know, we came and visited on the weekend, or she came and visited us, and it was really hard for her to be separated from her young children. But she always loved San Francisco, so she took me there a lot, and I just wanted to have that big city living experience. And so after, you know, got out of school, worked for a while, and at that time I was doing biochemistry research, so I had some good skills that were marketable down there. And so I just moved and got a job and worked at UCSF for 3.5 years. 3.5 years is my maximum time, apparently, that I can have a job, any one job. And then I was done. It was like, oof, big city living, it's too crowded. There's too many people who all want to do the same thing that you want to do, and you have to plan for all that traffic, and it got old.
What part of the city did you live in?
Laurel Heights. So, you know where that is? I call it the inner Richmond. You know, the Richmond is on the north side of the park going out to the ocean. This was just a little bit east of that. And then I think the next neighborhoods, I don't know, you're getting into Pacific Heights there. But we were just a block or two from the edge of the Presidio. And it was a super location, really great. Cherry Street, right across from Children's Hospital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And were you living there by yourself?
No, I was living there with my friend Peggy, who is how I came to Alaska in the first place.
Oh,
so
Peggy,
she's at
Montgomery.
Peggy McDonald Montgomery, yeah.
Mm.
So we grew up together in Reno.
Oh, I see.
We graduated from the same high school in the same year. And so I came to visit Peggy, and she was there at the Hobbit Hole in the summers because her husband Dennis was a fisherman, and she fished with him too until she started having babies. And the summer that I came to visit her, so I had become its teacher, and because I wanted a job with more time off.
What did you teach?
I taught biology or life science, because I was teaching middle school, and French, which is a great combo, because you get, in life science, every kid has to take that, so you get the full range, and then with French, you get a little bit higher level ability and more academically minded, so it was good to have the full range. And I, when I went back, well, I guess it was 1976. I know it was 1976. I went to the Olympics in Montreal, and that was my first exposure to French, and because I'd always taken Spanish in school, and I just fell in love with it, and I went right back and started taking French, I guess it was my sophomore and junior year of college, and I should have just changed my major, but I was a biology major, and I was in that track, and so then when I went back to school to get the teaching degree, they wanted you to have a major area and a minor, and I already had the major in biology. So I got to take a lot more French then. So that was, because I liked that a lot more than biology. But biology was definitely what helped me get a job, mm-hmm. all those research jobs. So
what do you think it was about French that drew you to it?
I really think it's a past life thing, which, you know, whatever, who knows that. But it's just so, one time I had this little French car, a Renault, and my friend goes, "Where's a Renault made?" And I said, "France." I mean, it just came out. And I had never taken any French. I knew nothing. And so it was so weird. And I just like the culture, and, you know, it's funny to me now when I think about the fact that the first exposure to French language was in Quebec, which is not a very pretty accent compared to real French in France. But I didn't distinguish at that time. I just knew I wanted to learn it.
Mm-hmm. And did you travel to France?
Oh, yes. I'm going to go there again this fall.
Oh, really? Where?
To the Dordogne. We're going to do a walking trip. So that's sort of southwest. And walk for a week and then have a house for a week.
Wow. That's going to be incredible.
I think so.
And probably much different from here, right?
Well, yes, probably. France is usually pretty green because they get quite a bit of rain, but I don't know, all bets are off now. This massive heat wave they've been having.
Oh, right.
Who knows? We're worried we're going to be really hot. But what can you do?
So tell me about sort of the first time.
You might want to turn that off while we call.
Yes.
We're getting a...
I can leave if you'd like.
As long as you're quiet. And as long as you're comfortable.
Totally.
Yeah. Okay.
Tea.
Don't be on the oral history, your little...
he wants to get on the couch, probably. Come on, Jake. Over here. Jakey. Okay, don't mind if I do. Okay, good boy. We do some dog sitting from time to time. Where were we?
I was asking you about what was it like seeing or coming to Alaska for the first time?
Oh, well, that was amazing. And I had wanted to come here for a long time before I finally did. And I remember I came with a friend that I had met in San Francisco named Lorna. And we landed in Juneau, and then we couldn't fly out to the coast because it was too windy that day. And so we had to get a hotel in downtown Juneau. We stayed at the Alaskan Hotel, which is really basic. And, you know, we went to the museum and just kind of did the Juneau things. And then the next day we were able to fly out. And I remember being shocked when I saw clear cuts on the way out, which have grown up a lot now. I don't even notice them now, but boy, I really noticed them. That was 1992.
What are clear cuts?
It's where they log a whole hillside. They don't just take, you know, the odd one. They take them all. Mm-hmm. So it's the most efficient way to log, but you know, it's not the best for the environment, I don't think. It's erosion is a problem and can be bad for salmon's dreams, and it's an unsightly way. I mean, if you just are going in picking the biggest trees, it's, but that's just not, that's not how commercial operations operate, you know. Although they may change to that. I'm not super knowledgeable about clear cutting, but it's unsightly. Mm. Looks like someone just took a razor to the mountainside. When you fly over next time, look for it and you'll see where it's been done. Mm. It won't be so shocking as it was for me then, because it was then it was very fresh. And here now it's all, you know, stuff's growing back in, but you'll see places where it's a lot smaller than the surrounding.
So that's what you were seeing as you were flying over.
Well, I saw that, and I remember being shocked. Anyway, landed in Elfin Cove, and somebody was there to pick us up, probably Dennis, in a little teeny boat, or it could have been Dennis in his fishing boat. I can't really remember that. And then we came to the Hobbit Hole through the gut, and I had seen photos from Peggy, so I kind of knew what to expect. But, you know, when you hear about off-the-grid living and the no boats, I mean the no cars and the no roads, you can't really wrap your mind around that until you see it. So we got there, and in those days it was a fishing commune. So it must have been a non-fishing day. So it was the month of June. And at that time, they'd have experimental openings on certain days of the week. And I'm not sure exactly when. We'll say it was Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And then they had 4 days when there was no opening. So whatever day we arrived, Dennis wasn't fishing because he came to pick us up. And then, you know, there'd be quite a few boats with a skipper and a deckhand, and there were some family boats. I don't know if you've surely met Tyga and Ryland, and, you know, those guys were like, I think Rye was maybe 5 or 7, and Tyga was 10 or 11 when I first got there. I'm not sure what year they were born, respectively. But, you know, their parents each had boats, and sometimes they'd stay on the beach, and sometimes they'd go fishing. And so every night the fleet would come in, and they had hired a cook gardener, who at that time was Jennifer Thompson. Jennifer Strami, so Eric's mother, was the cook gardener. So they hired this person to cook an evening meal and to keep the garden going. And that was Jennifer. And so she was my first friend.
And
I made.
Day, you mean?
Oh, I mean the Hobbit fleet. So that was Greg and Fred Babu and Deborah, and then there were at least 5 or 6 more boats. Steve Strami and Conley Ward, and you'll probably have to ask those guys for who all was in. I mean, I think I left some things there, like the old calendars.
Mm-hmm.
Not the ones that were artistic. And funny, it's Ronald. Colleen was talking about Ronald with his walking staff. He's the one who did the beautiful art on the calendars. So he was there that summer because I think he's Dennis's brother-in-law, and he was fishing with Dennis. So he was there. I met him that summer. Yeah, and it was kind of like having a big party every night, but it would get over, you know, promptly by 8 o'clock, probably 8:15. So dinner was at 7, and then everybody would leave. And you know, I always thought the worst part of the party is that people don't know when to leave. Mm-hmm. So it was great because it's always over early. And I helped quite a bit, you know, just because that's my nature. And then because Jennifer was pregnant with Eric, she was going to have to go in to town at a certain point before she got too far along. And so they needed somebody to fill in for cooking toward the end of the season. And so Greg asked me if I would do that. So I went back to Reno because I had some commitments there. And then I flew back up and cooked probably just for a couple weeks, which was okay, but stressful, you know. That was the first time I ever did something like that day after day after day in volume. But it was fine. Peggy helped me.
What sort of things did you cook?
Well, I'm sure there was salmon. I remember making something called pizza rustica, which is like it's a pie that you make a pastry crust, and then you fill it with all the things. There's like... it was vegetarian, so but there's the tomato-y part, and then like a ricotta layer. You put some green pepper in there and mozzarella, olives probably, and then you put a top crust on. So it's like a pie, but oh, awesome, Jake. You're sort of a slobbery guy, really. You really are. You really need to carry a napkin. Okay. So, and I remember making a turkey one time, and that's when Greg said, we ran out of mashed potatoes. And I remember going outside and crying, and then I thought, oh geez, I'm crying over mashed potatoes. So that's silly. And then I just made more food because he did not want to run out of food. And Greg was always really good. You know, if there was somebody that was late or wasn't there, he would make them a plate and put that aside in the kitchen because there were so many people, you know, that certain things would just get all eaten up. And I'm sure you've seen that. Mm-hmm. It's hard to make enough food because I think there's something that happens psychologically where the more people you have, people start to feel a little bit food insecure, so they eat more than they would ordinarily. They just pile their plate and they don't think, I can only really take 1/20th of what's here because there's 19 people behind me. They don't think that way. So you have to make extra to account for that mentality. Because I felt bad for the people at the end of the line. Like, ugh, not enough food. And then you have to learn to hold some back so you can replenish for those people.
Yeah, I've definitely noticed that. So how long were you cooking?
Well, that summer, I think it was just a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And then I went back to Reno because I had signed a contract to teach that year. And then the next summer, I took my students to France because they really wanted to go for just, you know, it was a short trip, I don't know, 9 days or something. And then I moved to the Hobbit Hole. And that summer, Jennifer and I shared the cook gardener job. And we did it for the whole season. And I feel like we did it another year, but I'd have to look at the calendars. These were just, the calendars were just regular, you know, whatever calendar, nothing special. But we kept track of how many meals were served to which boat. Because the way they did that was, you kept track of which boat ate meals and how many. You came up with a total number of meals served for the summer. And you knew you had all your costs, fuel, food, and the cook gardener salary. And then you just divided it up and came up with a per meal cost and billed it out to the skippers. So that's the bookkeeping end of that. And there was no profit involved. It was just straight costs. So those calendars, I think where I left them, and things have moved a lot, but they used to be, there used to be a little, there's a funny little tan colored thing. It kind of looks like a filing cabinet, and the lid lifts up, and there's a place for hanging files in there, and that's where they used to be. So that would be a source document that would, we could know. Although I don't know, I'm curious about oral history. Like, how much do you, would you, or you do just take what people say? Because I'm interested in things being accurate. So, I mean, I know I came there in 92. I know we got married in 95. But exactly, you know, what, did I cook with Jennifer for 2 years? Or, I don't know.
You're going to be recorded.
That's a sensitive recorder, Jake. You snore, dog. Don't breathe so loud.
Yeah, you'll be surprised. Sometimes the slightest sounds become so loud once they're recorded.
Is it gonna be okay? Should I move him?
Would it be okay to move him?
Let's try to put him on this blankie. Or maybe I can, we can move, because he wants to be on the couch. Sure. So why don't we go over to the table? No problem.
So I'm curious, what made you want to come back for a second summer?
I fell in love. Gregory Howe's eyes. Love to see, he has beautiful eyes. And I just wanted to be with him. And I feel like I remember, so when I told you that I was there for like 2 or 3 weeks, and then I had to go home, and then I came back. And on the way home, I was staying in Seattle for a couple days, and I was staying with a friend who lived just off Broadway. And I just was really kind of in tears, because it just seemed so, you know, there was nothing natural anywhere. It was just this total pavement everywhere, and no, nothing green. I mean, in Seattle, that's ironic. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's green, but I was just really touched by that experience of being so close to nature. So, and I don't think that that life would have suited me as a young person. I mean, I was 35 when I met Greg. So, but I, you know, I had lived in San Francisco. I'd done that big city thing. And I'd grown up in Reno, which is a small city. And I had never lived in the country. So it was a good thing. And my roots, you know, my grandma was a homesteader in rural Arizona, and so I could see the satisfaction of that life. And, you know, it was good. It was good for me.
When you were in Seattle, did you know that you were in love?
Oh yeah, definitely. And it was a good chance to go back and spend some more time and investigate it some more. And he just had a good character, much more so than many of the people that I had dated. So it was a good thing I wanted to know more about.
Did you find that when you returned the second time that anything had changed? Or that you had changed after a year?
Definitely the second summer was harder, but not, it didn't have anything to do with the two of us. It was just, you know, at first everybody was so excited that I was there and that Greg had a sweetie. And then they realized, oh, this is going to change our whole dynamic here. Because Greg, they used to say, oh, Greg has a summer personality and a winter personality. In the summer, he's grumpy. And in the winter, he's not. And it was that whole Hobbit Fleet thing had kind of it had grown to be pretty big and overwhelming. And, you know, he just wanted to come home in the evening and listen to his news and have dinner and go to bed. And there were all these screaming kids around. And, you know, he didn't love that, I don't think. But when I was there, of course, he wasn't grumpy. He was real super sweet. And so then, you know, the next summer, it was like, oh, I can see that this is going to potentially change the whole fishing commune thing. And as the years passed, I said, you know, why are you doing this if it makes you so unhappy? And I said, if all you want is an evening meal, I can do that. We don't have to have 30 people to dinner every night. And so then we floated the idea of building a kitchen on a barge where there'd be a mess hall, kitchen, cook's quarters, and storage for all the fishermen in the fleet. And nobody really wanted to put their money into that. So then we just sort of said, okay, well then this, as we know it, is over as of next year. And I think that first year that after we stopped it, I did cook for Fred because I, you know, special circumstances. And then the year after that, he figured all that out for himself. And everybody, you know, there were growing pains, but what we did was have a Friday potluck every Friday for the first several years. So they still had the camaraderie, but it wasn't every single night, and they didn't have to hire someone to do it.
Do you remember what year the sort of commune lifestyle stopped?
Well, that's what I'm saying about the calendars. For sure, it was not 92, and it was not 93, and I'm thinking it was probably 95. Was the first summer of not. And I'm usually pretty good with that stuff. But it could have been 94. So you have to look for the calendars.
Yeah, I'll make a note of that. And what was the year you got married?
95.
So, and when did you decide that you were going to stay here permanently, because you were coming back every summer?
Oh, I came in the summer of 92. Mm-hmm. I moved in the summer of 93.
Oh,
and that was that. And I was able to take a year's leave of absence from my job because that was just something you could do after you were tenured. So I did that, although I was quite sure that I was not going to be coming back to it, but you know, you could do that, so I did. And then I resigned when the time came. I kind of said to myself, if this guy ever kisses me, I'm going to marry him. You know, we had a very long courtship there during all those dinners. every single night, having dinner with all the 30 people. And then one night, it was right before I was going to leave, all of a sudden the house was empty and it was just the two of us. So they conspired to give us some room. So that was nice. And we just got along, you know. There was quite a lot of harmony, which was important to me. And then he came to visit me in Reno, and he had a broken ankle. And I lived in this tiny little apartment right downtown. You could see the circus clown right from my window, and he's hobbling around on his crutches, and you know, I'm teaching, and that's an overwhelming job. And we just got along really well, even in that tiny space, in that difficult circumstance. So, you know, you still want it to start out that way. And I think our next anniversary, we'll be married 25 years, so.
Oh, wow.
I can't believe it, but it's true.
So when was the first winter you spent?
So that would have been the winter of 93 to 94.
Mm.
And, you know, in the first few years, I didn't even travel anywhere without Greg. And then finally, I don't know, 5 years or 6 or 7 years in, I started going back to Reno in the fall on my own to see my family and stuff. But the first few years, we were very tight. And we traveled in the winter and went somewhere. I can't remember. We went to Belize once, and we went to Mexico quite a few times. But you had to find someone to stay there. So that at that point, it was usually our neighbors from the other side of the island, Lane and Karen. I don't know if you've met them yet. I hope you have.
I've heard of them. I haven't met them yet.
And then they said, we can't do that anymore. So then we started finding deckhands and different people that would stay.
You mean stay at the Hobbit Hole?
Yeah, because of the hydro and all. And we always had pets and the freezers. And, you know, it wasn't a situation where we were just going to drain the house and leave it. We needed to have somebody there to manage all those things. So
what was the longest period of time that you were gone from the Hobbit Hole?
Back then? Oh, I don't know, probably 6 weeks, if that. Mm-hmm. 5-6 weeks.
You talked about pets. What sort of pets did you have?
Long line of black cats and black dogs.
Mm.
When I first came there, we had, well, they had. Greg's dog was Oli, and that's his picture up there on the... there's two black dog pictures, and the one on the right is Oli. He was the patriarch. And then a black cat named Effie. And then Effie died. We got another black cat named Hector. And then Oli died, but he had bred with a golden in Juno. And so then we had Pearl, and their black lab golden retriever cross, which is a really nice cross. So we had Pearl until she died, and then we found Lacey on the internet, and she was also of that same cross, and that's Lacey up there on the left. And she died about a year and a half ago, and so we've been dogless since then. But we do have another black cat named Walter, who likes to live next door at Fred's mostly in the summertime, but in the winter he's here with us, and he comes and goes. He came in the middle of the night and waked us up. So now we're looking for another black dog. And we have a line on one. Maybe there's some puppies.
Oh. Earlier you spoke about feeling at home. When did you start feeling like the Hobbit Hole became your home, or even just Alaska in general?
Well, definitely not that second summer. That was a hard summer. I missed my family and friends a lot, and my whole, you know, comfortable way of life. I definitely, by the time we married, I was comfortable. So 3 years, 2 years after I moved here.
What about your art life in Reno did you miss the most?
Restaurants and movies, I think. And also I definitely had a little bit of an identity crisis after I wasn't a working person anymore. Well, I was working like crazy, but I didn't earn any money. When I did the cook gardener job with Jennifer, of course we got a little money, but it's not the same as your teacher paycheck every month. So then I thought, well, if you don't know who you are without that, that means that you're identifying yourself by your work, which is not something I wanted to do. So that was good to find out, because I didn't know that I was doing that. And, you know, I'd only been teaching for 3 years, so that wasn't a super long time. And I had, it was the whole financially independent thing that was an issue. But Greg was not weird in any way about money. And he just said, let's just say this is our money. And we have similar values, so we don't get into too many squabbles about how to spend our money. And we're both, you know, fairly thrifty and likely to buy similar quality things so that they last longer and, you know, get the hand-me-downs, whatever. I'm not a big spender, except on travel, and even then I don't travel in a very lush fashion. So that was interesting to discover, you know. But I mean, since I was a freshman in college, I was pretty much financially independent. So it was odd to not be. But we, you know, Greg made that transition pretty easy for me.
You said you missed your family too, the second summer especially.
I did. But my mom came and visited me, I think she said 14 times. And my dad came quite a few times, and that was totally great. My brother came once, my nephew, and my other nephew came once. So it was, you know, it wasn't like we were super close-knit or anything. It just was, the whole lifestyle is so different.
Do you think anyone in your family was surprised by your decision to stay here?
They probably were before they came to visit, and then once they came to visit, they saw what it was all about, and they were very understanding. Because every friend that ever came, you know, you're so nervous, and you're like, whoa, Alaska, you think you're going to need like a parka all the time or something. And then when they would come, and then once they left, they'd call and call and call, because then they really missed it. And you know, they had their big Alaskan selves that they had developed as a result of the visit. You know, it's just a whole, such a different experience to be in the wilderness.
Yeah, what do you think about it, is about the wilderness, that makes it so special for people?
It's just like the t-shirt says, it's wild as hell. And you definitely need to, you know, there's no 911 except channel 14 on the radio. So you need to make sure you have your wits about you and you've done all your safety things. And then you're gonna see things that you can't see anywhere else, you know, that you see six whales on the way to check the mail. It just blows your mind. Or, and I was somewhere the other day. So we took the boat to Juneau, and I guess it was when we were coming in to tie up here at the Gustavus dock, and I saw a sea lion, and I was like, oh, there's a sea lion over there. And I was like, oh, you're so cavalier about that now. But I mean, all those sea lions in Middle Pass, you go see those ever? Mm-hmm. It's astonishing. I mean, you know, they'll like fling some water up in your face. It's just, you know, just the life, the life that you can show people, and, you know, go around a Dick's arm and there's the bear with the three babies right on the beach, and seeing all that wildlife is big. And living a little closer to the land, you know, where you know where you're, the salmon came from, and you grew some of the food in the garden. Do you know Aldo Leopold?
It sounds familiar.
So he's an ecologist. Heyday was maybe the 30s and 40s. He wrote a really great book called A Sand County Almanac. And I believe it was in that book that I read, people need to know that heat doesn't come from the furnace and food doesn't come from the store. And I learned both of those things living at the Hobbit Hole for real. And it was good. It's satisfying in a way that having everything so easy if you have money is not. I mean, I think that's why the U.S. is such consumer cultures, because there's no satisfaction in the way people are living. They're looking to fill a hole spiritually that they, you know, because their lives are not satisfying. That's my theory.
Did you feel like before coming here that you are not satisfied spiritually?
No, I didn't. Not mm-hmm. me, for sure, because I have my whole, I have something else going on there. But I definitely, well, I don't know. Teaching is a challenging profession. Before I went into teaching and when I was being a biochem lab tech, I definitely felt like, you know, there's got to be something more. And I didn't want to go to grad school, because then what I really liked was the work at the bench. It wasn't, and once you get the advanced degree, then you're going to have to go after the money to be able to do the research. And I knew I didn't want to have to do that. So teaching was very satisfying, because I really like, I like the middle school age kids. I just fell in love with all of them. And so, you know, that was good. And it's tiring. It's to do a good job, you're going to be really tired at the end of the day and at the end of the year. And so it was, I did have a lot of satisfaction in my life. But I've never been a big consumer, so.
But you've seen people who you feel, I guess, take, like you said, take for granted that you can get food at a store.
I think that's pretty common, you know. I mean, and people plop themselves down in front of their TV and watch some mindless stuff. And, you know, it's all very numbing. And people are numbing with alcohol, and they're numbing with drugs, and they're numbing with food, and they're numbing with shopping, and they're just disconnected. So I feel like living that way, you get a more a feeling of connection to the world. And everybody wants to feel connected. There's nobody who doesn't.
Did you feel very connected to the people as well, in addition to being connected to the land?
Oh, definitely. And, you know, the longer I was there, the more I got involved in things in Elfin Cove, and, you know, that was not all golden, but I started doing jobs over there, and it's been hard to disconnect because there aren't a lot of people to do those jobs, and it's been hard to find some steady people to do them. So, yeah, I definitely felt connected and still do.
Are you okay to keep going, or do you want to take a short break?
I'm going to get a glass of water.
Yeah. Hang on, get some water. So, let's see, where are we historically or chronologically? So we've gotten to your wedding, and then after that, where you stopped having the dinners every night, you would just have the potlucks on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me a little bit more about the years that followed.
Well, Greg was fishing in the summers, and I was mostly there on the beach and, you know, doing the garden. And when, at that point, I didn't have so much going on, and I was able to actually keep that big middle garden weeded and the strawberry garden weeded and the front garden weeded, and we had things in the upper garden then too. So for a few years it was like that, and then I started getting involved in the cove, and then I could not keep
we
started this guest house business, and I think the first, I want to say it was like 90, well, we built the back room off the guest house. So we used to call that building the studio, because I don't know if you're going to interview Kim Nay, Wayne's wife.
Maybe.
She built that. She was Greg's sweetie, and she built that as a potting studio. So we always called it the studio. And that's where the cook gardener usually lived. But it didn't have any plumbing in it. So we built the bedroom and bathroom off the back, and plumbed in the bathroom and plumbed in the kitchen. And then, without any big plan, for some reason we just did that. I can't remember why. And that, I think, was happening in like 95, the winter of 95. And then, like the very next year, I got this call from Spirit Walker Expeditions, which is a kayaking outfit here that does guided kayak trips, and they said, we're looking at doing some kind of lodge to lodge trip, and, you know, do you think that you could take people there? And I said, yeah, I think we could. And so I remember saying to myself, oh, it's really true, if you build it they will come. Because that's what happened, with no, you know, we didn't have any idea about that happening. So anyway, that started, and super low level, you know, I just had a few guests, and then that just built a little bit. And then there were some lean fishing years, and so we tried to bump up the guest house business a little bit. And somewhere in there I got my vessel master license, so I could take people out in the boat on charter and charge them. And so I did that. And and then when Greg stopped fishing, when he sold the power troller boat, the Kita, to Ryland Bell, then he was there to help me, and we could, you know, up the number of guests, because it was hard to do it all by myself. And I could have had an employee, but that is a whole complicated thing, because it's not like they just show up for work and then go away. You have to house them and feed them, and you really take on their whole, all their problems. And, you know, a business is sort of a family. So, and then once Zach came along, the guest house thing was crazy busy, because he was really good at getting people to come and stay.
Which, Zach?
Yeah, we were never good at that.
What was Zach's involvement?
Well, he, once the Hobbit Hole was going to become the Indian Islands Institute, and he was, you know, bringing people there before he owned the property, we were really busy. Some big groups, and that was fine. It was great. It was lucrative. And then I was working in the Cove doing the billing for the electric utility, and I'm doing the books for the store, and sometime I did the books for the fuel dock, and I was the secretary of the corporation for like 4 years, and then another year or two when somebody resigned. So that was a mixed thing. It wasn't, you know, when you get put yourself out there in public, there's always people that have a lot of criticisms, which was hard for me to take, but that happened.
What were some of them about?
Well, you have to go on the Elfin Cove, what is it? Alaskans for Alaska, Elfin Cove. And so the neighbors on the other side of the island, Lane and Karen and Travis Lewis is not on the other side of the island. He lives in Hoonah now, but at that time he lived in Elfin Cove. And they just accused me of malfeasance, and they've got a lot of stuff on their website that's, to me, it's like, people say, I can't believe you haven't sued over that. But, you know, I didn't do anything wrong. I was just trying to help my community. And, you know, they have a misunderstanding, as far as I'm concerned, about what I did. And I'm not the only person that they are down on. They really don't like tourism. So they got angry once I started the guest house business. And that pretty much was kind of the end of the friendship, which is really sad. You know, you always hear that thing about, well, there's only 5 people in the town and they don't get along. And I'm like, well, that happened to me. I was so strange. So different world views.
It must have been really hard to go through them.
Well, yeah, it was just weird. You know, I mean, we weren't super close, but it does seem odd that you can't get along with your neighbors. And then, you know, I never would have believed that that could happen to me until it did, because I'm pretty easy to get along with, I think. But they had some very, you know, firm ideas about the way things should be. And I've been told that they have a banner hanging over there that says tourism rapes Alaska.
It's still there.
And that, you know, it used to be that little cruise ships would anchor there in their, that bay out in front of their house, and they really didn't like that. And that was probably the beginning of their hatred for tourism. And, you know, it's not that there's not some truth to that. I mean, I feel really sorry for the people in Hoonah who are going to have like 400,000 cruise ship people there in a town of 800 in a summer. I mean, when is it enough? And, you know, did those people sign up for that? I bet they didn't. So, and you know, sometimes in Elfin Cove, those little cruise ships come in there and you're trying to just get something done, get from one side of town to the other, and all these people are just, you know, looking at it like it's Disneyland. And for them it is, but it really is a real town with real work going on too. So, you know, there's an upside and a downside.
So what was the process of having the institute at the Hobbit Hole? What did that look like?
Well, our role was pretty much room and board. And most people, the students usually are camping, or they're in what dorm-style accommodations, which have evolved through the years. I mean, when we first started, that yurt wasn't up. The warehouse was always there. Some people camped, and then they put the faculty mostly in the guest house. So, you know, and then they held classes in different places, like in our, that the main room of our house, and then sometimes upstairs in the warehouse, sometimes out on the lawn, depending on weather. And, you know, sometimes they would ask us to do, I don't know, to talk about a specific thing. I can't remember now. And they'd help, like, in the garden, you know, depending on the season. Early groups could plant the onions or whatever. And I just remember being so impressed with the students because they were so smart. And, you know, you teach them whatever you wanted them to do. And in general, they did a fantastic job, really listened to you and did what you asked. And then harvesting, same thing. So that was my main interaction with them.
But how did this connection with Zach begin?
Well, Zach came there as a child. Like, I want to say he was like 12 the first time. He could have been 11. And his dad...
How about his mother naming it the hospital?
You're gonna get your chance, honey. So Zach's mother, Carolyn Elder Brown, named the Hobbit Hole when she came over there with Fred. You're probably going to hear this a bunch of times. She said, why don't you guys should call this place the Hobbit Hole, because it was the 70s and the Hobbit books were big, and that name stuck. And so this was long before Zach. And then Zach came over with his dad, Bill Brown, who was a great friend of Greg's dad, Bob Howe. So Bob Howe and Bill Brown and Zach came over. And I think it just made a big impression on him, which I did not know at the time. I just remember, you know, they're sitting at my table and I made some kind of white clam spaghetti or something. And I remember Zach saying that he didn't eat processed food. And I was like, wow, you know, this is a little twerp sitting at my table saying he doesn't eat. I said, well, this is what's for dinner. You know? So he was saying something like that at 12. He was getting that indoctrination, which I had never heard. I don't think I'd ever heard anyone say that, let alone a 12-year-old. And anyway, so he's always been kind of intense. And like I said, I had no idea that it had made that impression on him. So then the next piece is, well, at least 15 years must have passed. He would have been sometime, I'd say between 25 and 30. And we were going to sell. And we had met a realtor along the way who said, if you ever want to sell this property, I'd like to represent it. So we got in touch with him and he came to visit to, you know, check it all out, make a little video, whatever. His name was Mike Mansker. And then we brought him back over here to Gus Davis to catch his jet back to Oregon. And he and Zach ran into each other on the Ngoonberry Trail. And that's when Zach found out that it was for sale. And he said, oh, I have to have that. We can't sell that to the bastards. So then he just got a fire for it. He caught fire. And for us, it was certainly the best legacy that we could imagine leaving. You know, if we weren't going to find a private buyer, because we didn't want it to be a commercial charter outfit resource extractor. And, you know, Zach's vision of changing the future by changing the hearts and minds of young people is brilliant. And I think, you know, it's great.
So why did you decide to sell it in the first place?
It was time. It's, you know, the satisfaction piece was over and it had just become a lot of labor. And, you know, Greg was the one with all the responsibility. And when the power goes out, you're like, uh-oh, what's gone wrong now? And it's a big problem to solve. And he was just tired of solving the problems. And so it was just time to go and move somewhere where life was just a little easier.
And then you knew that you wanted to settle in Gustavus?
Definitely. I mean, there's no getting Greg out of Alaska. And I don't really want to leave Alaska either. And this is a very nice town. And we have lots of friends here. And it's so much, I mean, the it's so much different and so much easier just even to come and go from here. Because there's many planes a day, the year round, you know, weather permitting, the ferry, and that may be going away given our state's political situation, but I'd be surprised if it got less than one a week. But who knows? And, you know, the store. This is easier. And, you know, that was kind of a solitary life in the long season. In summer, you'd wish for some solitary days, but in winter, there were plenty of them. So it was just time. Time to pass it off to some young people. It's a young person's life, all that labor.
Do most people that sort of live the kind of homesteading lifestyle then move on once they get older?
I'm not sure I can speak authoritatively to that. I know there was a couple who lived in Funter Bay, which is a bay between here and Juneau, and they definitely got old enough to where they needed to have a little easier life. And they raised a couple kids there, and then they sent their kids to school in Sitka once they weren't thriving on their own homeschool. And then they moved to Sitka, and I don't know if they, anyway, they were there in Sitka, and then they went back to Funter, and then they moved to California, and they were both from California originally. So it may be a situation where if you're not born to it, mm-hmm. you know, you're fascinated by it, and then you go do it, and then however many years later, the novelty wears off, kind of like San Francisco was for me after 3 years. But like Lane and Karen on the other side of the island, I don't know that they're thinking of ever going anywhere else, but your body breaks down and you physically can't do it anymore, you know, getting all that firewood in and everything. So it's self-limiting, I think. Although there was a guy who lived up in Dundas Bay and he knew that he was going to die there. And pilots say, and some people say he was a squatter, and I don't know the details of that. I mean, I've heard people rosy talk about him and people kind of down talk about him. But what I remember mainly is that pilots would fly over making sure there was still smoke coming out of his chimney. And then once there was no more smoke, they knew that he was dead. And then someone must have gone in and dealt with it. So it's self-limiting, I think, in a way that most people don't live a life that is that physical.
Was making the transition difficult in any way?
There to here? Mm-hmm. Moving by boat, I don't recommend, but there's really no other way to do it.
Moved everything?
Well, we left a lot of things, and thankfully. And our plan was to have, you know, somebody's big landing craft and do it all in one thing, but then that just didn't work out with their schedule. So then we just, at the same time, I was kind of trying to help Elfin Cove transition. So there were quite a few trips that we needed to make last, a year ago, spring and summer. And so that's what we did. And we just took what we could take in each trip. And everybody was very helpful, helping us get it down to the boat and everything. Coulter was awesome. So it was not that hard, you know. Now that I've been in the house for a year, it all feels pretty. The first year was definitely, you know, everything. We can't even remember where we put stuff in the cupboards or anything. But now things are getting more settled. The garden was easier the second year.
Are there parts about living in the Hobbit Hole that you miss?
Well, sometimes I'd come home to the Hobbit Hole after a day in Elfin Cove and, you know, it'd be a beautiful sunny day, blue sky, and that how green the island is. There's this Weezer song, Island in the Sun.
Yeah.
And it's, Greg saw on my Facebook page the other day, they had a memory of there's no place more beautiful than Southeast Alaska when the sun shines. And, you know, you're getting a completely, although you're not being in the sun as much as it has been here, you're probably in the fog out there a lot.
We had a week of really nice sunshine.
Oh, good. And that, I missed that for sure. That was beautiful. And, yeah, I kind of missed the garden. But not that many things.
Have you been back recently?
No. It's probably been about a year since we got the last load of stuff. Because some of it's hard. It's hard for me to see the changes, you know. So I need to let a little time go by.
Like, what is hard for you to see?
It's not really anybody's home anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of a business now. And so there's not that sort of pride in the way it's kept that I had, you know. But that's just my, you know, I think a lot of people, when they leave a house, it's hard to see what the next people do to it. And it's nothing, you know.
So then, what are some of your favorite things to do here now?
Well, you can walk like crazy here, and I do. And, you know, there it was hard to get your 10,000 steps in a day, and here, if you take a good long walk, you can easily get to 15. So there's a lot of walking, and I have a friend here, and I go hang out with him. He needs somebody to help him for a few hours, a couple, 3 days a week, so I do that. And we take yoga classes. There's circuit training 3 days a week. Not right now, but in general, it's, you know, probably at least 10 months out of the year. I don't know what I do, but I am very, very busy. I feel like I'm going from thing to thing to thing. Tonight we have an international dinner where we've done, I think this is the fifth one. So we did, first one we did sort of Scandinavian last December. We do it about every quarter. Then we did Brazilian because I went to Brazil. Then we did...
With Jennifer?
No, she doesn't live here.
Mm-hmm.
She lives... I went to see her in Brazil. Yes, right. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And then I traveled with another friend around the country. And then... what's the next one we did? We did Indian, and I feel like there's one more, but tonight it's Asian fusion, which everyone goes, what does that mean? I go, well, let's just say it's all kinds of Asian, and what I'm making is Korean tacos. For the first time I'm trying it, I have no idea. But I was in Reno in June to see friends, and we went to Food Truck Friday, and I got to have my first, it said it was a Laos taco. So, you know, you've got a tortilla with the Asian-y flavored meat in it, and it was so good, so I'm gonna try it.
Is this with a group of friends?
Yes. And so that's something that I do from time to time. And I'm still involved with the store in the Cove and doing their books, so that takes some time. But I found somebody to take that over. So that's should be done with that within a year. Train her up bit by bit, which is great. And, you know, we're still getting settled, still building the garden here, and there's things that aren't done yet in the house, but not many.
And you're still doing art, you were talking about earlier.
Not nearly as much as I'd like, but I do, you know, pull together the odd handmade card for a friend's birthday every now and again. Yeah.
It sounds like your life here is very full.
It is very full, and I'm glad about that. We have happy hour every Friday night. Sometimes we get a break this week and last week. There's a gal whose grandmother used to do the happy hour after Greg's dad stopped doing it because he died. And so she's here, so she's having it at her house because that was also a tradition. And then Zach's dad and mom did it for years after Mary stopped doing it. And now that we're here, we're back to doing it. And that's great. It's gotten a little crazy out of hand big now. So it's good to take a break.
Before we end, is there anything that you'd like to mention or add, talk about?
Well, I'm so, so, so grateful that I got to have this life. Because it's been really good.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.